Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. We hope you all had a great weekend enjoying some sunny springtime weather, but now the temperatures are heating up, and the National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat warning for our region. Find out just how hot it will get and what precautions to take on today's show. Next up, from Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories, including the latest on President Donald Trump's tariffs that aim to curb immigration from Mexico. Hear why Congressman Duncan Hunter is under fire over remarks he made while speaking in defense of an accused war criminal and discussing his own actions in Iraq during the 2004 siege of Fallujah, where many civilians were killed. The FDA has announced a recall of frozen blackberries and packages of mixed berries due to hepatitis A contamination, and we'll have details. A gas line break near Parkway Plaza Shopping Mall in El Cajon on Friday caused some major inconveniences for shoppers, diners, motorists, and trolley riders. But fortunately, no one was injured. Hear more on today's show. We'll have news today about a new ordinance in El Cajon allowing more dogs and cats per household, and then we'll share some inspiring stories of graduates at Grossmont and Cuyamaca Community Colleges who overcame serious adversities to earn their diplomas. On the second half of our show, our newsmaker interview today is with Victor Contreras, an actor and writer who will be bringing to life some historical figures from our region's colorful past at the upcoming Bonita Fest, as well as an event in Old Town, and it's all part of San Diego's 250th anniversary this year. Hot temperatures and low humidity mean fire weather is here, so Cal Fire has issued a no-burn proclamation, and we'll have details on today's show. We'll also have tips for you on where to find cool zones as the temperatures hit triple digits this week. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The National Weather Service has issued an extreme heat warning for San Diego County's deserts from Tuesday morning through Wednesday this week, when high temperatures are forecast to reach 110 to 114 degrees. Lows of 80 to 84 are forecast at night. High temperatures and low humidity also increases fire danger as well as temperatures. Excessive heat is also forecast in other desert communities outside San Diego County, including Indio, Palm Springs, La Quinta, and Coachella Valley. To avoid heat stroke or heat exhaustion, stay indoors in an air-conditioned area if possible, and be sure to drink plenty of fluids. Please check up on relatives and neighbors, especially those who are elderly or disabled. Beach areas will be cooler, however, with morning fog possible along the coast. And starting Thursday, we should have the weather cooling off again. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, June the 10th, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. Trump declares victory in negotiations with Mexico, but says he could still return to tariffs. Also on our Monday rundown, we'll take you to a state where salaried workers could soon get overtime, and New Mexico expands cannabis options to treat opioid addiction. Now our top story, President Trump and his acting Homeland Security Secretary Sunday defended their new agreement with the Mexican government to curb migration at the southern border. The Washington Post reports they were in effect striking back at Democratic critics, including accusations that at least some parts of that deal predated Trump's recent tariff threats. On Twitter, Trump said New Mexico was not being cooperative on the border before the deal reached Friday. Now he said, "I have full confidence, especially after speaking to their president yesterday, that they will be very cooperative and want to get the job properly done." The Post adds that Trump said he could move to reimpose the tariffs if Mexico doesn't follow through on its promises. Some aspects of the deal remain to be announced. Trump said one in particular will be announced at the appropriate time. And salaried workers in Washington state who log long hours on the job soon could be eligible for overtime. Eric Teganoff explains.
The Department of Labor and Industries has proposed raising the threshold for overtime pay for the first time in more than four decades. Currently, any salaried worker making more than $23,660 a year is exempt from overtime pay laws. That threshold is less than the annual pay for someone working a full-time job on the state's minimum wage. Economic Opportunity Institute Policy Director Marilyn Watkins says as the law stands now, bosses can make salaried employees work 50 to 60 hours a week without costing the company any additional money for overtime.
So you're losing out both on income for your family, but also the ability to have some control of your time and the ability to spend time with your family for rest or personal time.
The income threshold would increase at different rates, with a lower threshold for small businesses and a higher one for larger companies, until it reaches nearly $80,000 a year for all employees in 2026. At that time, the new rule would cover more than 250,000 workers. Opponents believe the measure goes too far and say the state should wait for the federal government's rule on this.
An update to this rule would guarantee that salaried workers have access to leave. Public comment is open on the overtime rule at the Department of Labor and Industries website through September the 6th. Volunteers and organizations across the state of Ohio stepping up to help care for some of the state's most vulnerable residents. Mary Sherman has our report.
County probate courts are tasked with appointing a guardian when a family member is unwilling or unable to care for an incompetent adult. And without enough funding to pay guardians, courts have relied heavily on probate lawyers and volunteers. The Central Ohio Area Agency on Aging's Volunteer Guardian Program matches volunteers with nursing home patients who need someone to manage their care. Malcolm Tanksley has been a volunteer for 18 years.
Some people can't get outside the nursing home, so you want to do everything you can to make them feel good. The most rewarding part is knowing that they know somebody cares. Somebody's there for them, somebody that will make sure that they're taken care of, and in a sense, they trust you.
About 47,000 Ohio adults were under a guardian's care at the end of 2017, and that population is likely to grow, as the number of Ohioans over 65 is projected to increase 50% from 2010 to 2030. This story was produced with original reporting from Katie Ellington for Ion Ohio, the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism, and is funded in part by the Ohio News Media Foundation and the George Gunn Foundation, and produced in association with Media in the Public Interest.
Opioid use disorder tops a list of several new qualifying conditions for people in New Mexico who want to enroll in the state's medical cannabis program. Here's Ross Brown.
David Morgan with the Department of Health says New Mexico has reduced its drug overdose mortality rate from second in the nation to 17th. He says the health department believes expanding the qualifying conditions for cannabis use could help continue the state's downward trend.
We are hoping that being able to add opioid use disorder as a qualifying condition to the medical cannabis program can help further mitigate drug overdose deaths in the state.
At least eight other states, including California, recognize opioid dependency as a qualifying condition that some choose to treat using medical marijuana.
And finally, Dan Hyman reports this spring renewable sources for a time generated more U.S. electricity than coal. That's according to federal figures.
The numbers fluctuate day to day, but last April, for the first time recorded by the Energy Information Agency, renewables put more power into the nation's grid than coal-fired plants. House Delegate Evan Hansen says wind and solar have been booming for years. He says there are now about 250,000 solar jobs in the U.S., but Hansen says West Virginia is missing out because of state policies.
If you look at the states that border West Virginia, there are thousands of solar-related jobs, but in West Virginia, there's only a couple hundred, and the reason for that is our policies. It's not that we have less sunlight.
Coal's allies have leaned on the history and traditional importance of mining to the region, and they're arguing that coal is more reliable. The EIA predicts renewables will provide almost one-fifth of the nation's electricity next year.
I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week with Public News Service. We are member and listener-supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Republican Congressman Duncan D. Hunter is drawing fire for admitting that he fired at civilians in Iraq while serving combat duty with the Marines, also posing with corpses of dead enemy combatants. Hunter has been vocal in his support of Chief Special Warfare Operator Edward Gallagher, a Navy SEAL charged with war crimes including shooting at civilians and fatally stabbing a young wounded prisoner, then posing with a corpse. During a town hall meeting in Ramona over Memorial Day weekend, Hunter said of Gallagher,
"Because Eddie did one bad thing that I'm guilty of too. taking a picture with the body and saying something stupid, and then texting that. So he took a picture with the body, with his knife out, and texted it to some buddies and said, I got this one with my knife. Okay? I've taken pictures just like that when I was overseas. Didn't text them to anybody, didn't put them on Facebook or Instagram, but a lot of my peers, a lot of us, have done the exact same thing.
Hunter doubled down on those remarks during a later taped interview with the online site Zero Blog 30, in which he stated,
well, then how do you judge me? So I was an artillery officer, and we fired hundreds of rounds into Fallujah.
Right.
Killed probably hundreds of civilians, if not scores, if not hundreds of civilians. Probably killed women and children, if there were any left in the city when we invaded. So do I get judged, too?
As for the charges Gallagher faces of murdering a teenage ISIS fighter who had been brought in for medical treatment, Hunter told Zero Blog 30, I frankly don't care if he was killed. I just don't care. He added that even if Gallagher did stab the wounded prisoner to death, he still, quote, deserves a break, indicating Gallagher should not be held accountable for violating the military code of justice. Barstool Sports, which publishes the Zero Blog 30 podcast, released a statement Sunday calling Hunter's rhetoric, quote, horrific. U.S. soldiers have been prosecuted for taking photos with dead bodies of enemy combatants, usually with aggravating circumstances such as desecrating a body. Shooting at civilians, if done intentionally, can be charged as a war crime, but not civilian deaths from what the military calls collateral damage when targeting enemy forces. International human rights organizations have long raised concerns that some U.S. military actions in Fallujah violated the International Code of Justice, including what some have termed a massacre of civilians there in 2004. The military has contended that U.S. soldiers were fired upon by insurgents and that the military siege was justified. Hunter's unit was in Fallujah in 2004. So was Aaron Glantz, an unembedded journalist who reports on the investigative reporting site Reveal that, quote, retired General James Mattis earned the nickname Mad Dog for leading U.S. Marines into battle in Fallujah, Iraq in April 2004. In that assault, members of the Marine Corps, under Mattis's command, shot at ambulances and aid workers. They cordoned off the city, preventing civilians from escaping. They posed for trophy photos with the people they killed. Glantz adds, each of these offenses has put other military commanders and members of the rank and file in front of international war crimes tribunals, noting that this tradition dates back to World War II and has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. According to Glantz's eyewitness account, during the Siege of Fallujah, which I covered as an unembedded journalist, Marines killed so many civilians that the municipal soccer stadium had to be turned into a graveyard. He notes that in the years since then, Division Commander Mattis has repeatedly protected American service members who killed civilians, wiping away criminal charges against Marines accused of massacring 24 Iraqi civilians in Haditha in 2005, and granting clemency to soldiers convicted of murdering a disabled Iraqi man by shooting him in the face four times in 2006. Even if the orders to fire artillery rounds into the city of Fallujah in 2004 were legal, Hunter's apparent lack of any remorse over killing innocent women and children is disturbing to some constituents. Many veterans return suffering post-traumatic stress disorder, haunted by guilt over their role in such bloody conflicts. But apparently not Hunter, the first Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran elected to serve in Congress. President Donald Trump has indicated he is considering pardoning Gallagher and other U.S. soldiers if they are convicted of war crimes. Some have suggested that Hunter, a staunch Trump supporter, may be angling for a pardon for himself if Hunter is convicted of felonies when his own federal corruption trial begins in September. Hunter and his wife are charged with stealing $250,000 in campaign funds and spending it on lavish personal expenses, including vacations in Italy and Hawaii, expensive jewelry, tuition at his children's school, and airfare for the family's pet rabbit. Hunter is facing 60 federal charges. If convicted, whether pardoned or not, Hunter would almost certainly face expulsion from Congress by the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. Three Republicans and one Democrat have announced plans to run for Hunter's 50th congressional seat, which spans San Diego and South Riverside counties, including large portions of San Diego's East County and North County. The three GOP contenders vying to replace Hunter are El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, Temecula Mayor Matt Ron, and retired Navy SEAL Larry Wilski. Democrat Amar Campanajar came within just a few percentage points of toppling Hunter in the 2016 election, after Hunter's indictment. He has amassed a large campaign war chest for the 2020 race, which has drawn national attention. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert. The FDA is warning consumers about hepatitis A virus contamination in frozen packages of blackberries and tripleberry medley products. The private selection products made by Kroger were sold in Kroger, Ralph's, Food for Less, Fred Meyer, Dillon's, and other grocery chains across the United States. The recalled products have a long shelf life with Best Buy dates through June and July of 2020. Now, if you've eaten any of those frozen berries since May 24th, and if you haven't had the hepatitis A vaccine, the FDA recommends that you talk with your doctor about getting vaccinated, even if you haven't become ill. If you've already been vaccinated or previously had hepatitis A, you do not need the vaccine. Hepatitis A can result in a liver infection that may not be apparent. However, when symptoms occur, they can range in severity from a mild illness lasting a few weeks to a severe illness lasting months. The disease is spread when someone ingests the virus, usually through person-to-person contact or from eating contaminated food or drinks. Hepatitis A can have a long incubation period and have serious health consequences for some people, especially those who are immune-compromised. People infected with hepatitis A may not have symptoms until 15 to 50 days after exposure, which can make it hard to determine the exact exposure that led to illness. Symptoms may include fever, headache, fatigue, loss of appetite, nausea, vomiting, abdominal issues, yellowing of the skin or eyes known as jaundice, dark urine, and pale stools. Young children may not show these symptoms. Now, at this time, the FDA and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are not aware of any cases of hepatitis actually linked to consuming the Kroger Private Selection brand frozen blackberries. The FDA is continuing to investigate to find out if there may be other products that are tainted. Meanwhile, the FDA encourages consumers with questions about food safety to call 1-888-SAFE-FOOD.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news across our border region.
A gas line ruptured by construction crews Friday in El Cajon forced evacuation of the Rock Church and several nearby businesses, including the Lexus car dealer and Black Bear Diner. The gas line break at North Marshall Avenue and Petrie Street also forced closure of Fletcher Parkway, a major thoroughfare, and shutdown of the trolley line for several hours until the gas could be shut off by SDG&E. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
El Cajon is going to the dogs and cats. The city council has voted unanimously to allow pet owners to have up to 4 dogs or cats, or a combination of dogs and cats, up to a total of 4. Formerly, the city allowed no more than 2 dogs or 2 cats per household, though exceptions were made for puppies and kittens not yet old enough for adoption. Councilman Gary Kendrick, who formerly served on the city's planning commission, says El Cajon has received many requests from people seeking to add more pets, but very few complaints about pet owners. Kendrick, a dog owner himself, says everybody loves their dogs, adding that many people now want dogs for security as well as companionship. Obtaining an administrative zoning permit will still be required, however, for anyone seeking to own more than 4 cats and or dogs. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
Almost 2,700 graduates from Grossmont and Cuyamaca colleges are receiving 5,652 degrees and certificates at commencement ceremonies in June, setting a new record as the largest graduating class from the 2 East County colleges. Dr. Cindy Miles says she's proud of all the graduates, adding their lives will be transformed forever by what they learned here. With the college focusing more on student support, increasing university transfer rates, and greater career opportunities over the past 10 years, The number of degrees and certificates awarded at the two colleges has increased by 178%, and the number of Grossmont and Cuyamaca College graduates has risen by 78%. Shakur Collins, the student commencement speaker at Grossmont College, is a study in determination. After high school, she was accepted to 14 universities and had chosen the University of California, Irvine, with scholarships to cover her full education. But during her freshman orientation, she suffered a medical crisis from a building of spinal fluid in her head, which left her with permanent and nearly total vision loss. Forced to drop out from UC Irvine and lose tens of thousands in scholarship dollars, she enrolled at Grossmont College, where the college's Accessibility Resource Center assigned her a personal scribe and use of an electronic screen magnifier. Now she is graduating with a straight A average and is set to transfer to UC San Diego in the fall as a psychology major. Meanwhile, she's working as a psychology tutor and in her spare time sings with the Sweet Adeline's musical group and is training in the martial arts. Grossmont has allowed me to take the time I need to heal, she says, thanking her professors and mentors at the community college. Cuyamaca College commencement speaker Akilah Scott is the first of six siblings raised in a single-parent home to pursue a university degree. A full-time waitress who carried 22 units in her final semester and played for the women's volleyball team during the fall, Scott described her daily schedule as beyond crazy. She is also the primary income earner in the household since her mother is legally blind and unable to work. She started as a chemistry major, but a philosophy class exposed her to Socrates and other great thinkers. She will transfer in the fall to California State University, Long Beach, as a philosophy major. She calls her mother a superhero who inspired her despite being legally blind, and says she's learned while at Cuyamaca College that we can't allow hardships to be an obstacle. My experience here has also led me to understand the importance of embracing change. The second commencement speaker at Cuyamaca College is Dawood Rafoka, an Iraqi refugee who started at Grossmont College and Cuyamaca Colleges in 2015, not remembering how to multiply or divide. He graduates with an associate degree in mathematics and outstanding achievement awards in math, English, and more. His English language skills developed so rapidly that just three semesters after starting college, he was hired as a tutor to help others learning English as a second language, also making videos to help the ESL department. He became a resource specialist and student ambassador for Grossmont's outreach department. His upbeat attitude and outgoing nature belie his formative years growing up in a northern Iraqi village, where car bombings and terrorist attacks are a constant reminder to maintain a low profile and not to draw attention. At 17, he left with his brother for a safer refuge in Turkey, where they were eventually joined by his parents. 2 years later, the family was granted permission to move to El Cajon. He once believed that an education was not in his future, but now he says, I wouldn't have reached this station of my life without professors' generosity with their office hours at both colleges and the constant support of services like the tutoring center. Now graduating with a perfect 4.0 grade average, Dawood will transfer this fall to San Diego State University, where he plans to pursue a career in computer engineering. And just 2 weeks ago, he became a naturalized U.S. citizen, embodying the American dream. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is John Fistier.
CAL FIRE has announced suspension of outdoor residential burn permits in San Diego, Imperial, and Riverside counties for all the areas under state firefighting control due to high fire danger, and in East County that includes the unincorporated areas. Heavy winter rains fueled dense growth of brush, which poses a severe fire danger as it dries out. The ban also prohibits campfires on public lands to only facilities and fire pits in established campgrounds. The suspension does not cover campfires on private property. While rains as late as May are expected to delay the brush fire season, a report published in May by the National Interagency Fire Center found that while the fire season was off to a slow start nationally, California can expect above normal potential for large wildfires this summer as those grasses dry out, providing tinder for explosive fires. CAL FIRE has already responded to over 800 wildfires this year, the Los Angeles Times reports, including recent brush fires locally in Dulzura that shut down Highway 94 last week. So please, everyone, be careful. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, I'm here with Victor Crosswaite Contreras, who is a descendant of the early Spanish soldiers who came to found the missions of California. He's also descended from one of the early sheriffs of Old Town. He's a professional actor, writer, historian, and educator. He puts together presentations about people who actually lived in California in our past, for educational groups, and he's here today with us to talk about a very special birthday coming up, the 250th birthday of the city of San Diego's founding. Victor, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to get together with you.
Yes, this is not your first visit. We've enjoyed some of your historical characters on here before.
So absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about what's coming up for the 250th birthday for San Diego.
This year is the 250th anniversary of San Diego. And there are a number of activities being held throughout the city and throughout the county, because although we focus on San Diego as a city, but remember, most of the cities that are now in San Diego County did not exist at the time. They were just ranchos.
Right. I know there's been some activities that you weren't involved in directly, including some things at the San Diego Mission, where later this month there's some presentations of James Hubbell's artwork and some special ceremonies that are going to be coming up all summer long. There's been some things at Old Town, but you're involved with some programs coming up in Bonita, I understand.
Now, remembering, Bonita didn't exist as a city back then. It was a rancho. So it falls into the 250th anniversary because they were ranchos there.
So this is the Bonita Museum and Cultural Center presenting Nuestra Frontera, our South Bay Families at the Border. There's a fundraiser June 29th, and then there's going to be a big event coming up in July. Tell us about that.
July 6th. They call it Bonita Fest, so it's a celebration of the Bonita area. And at the same Bonita Museum, I will be performing all day during the day.
And these are community events, so you don't have to be
absolutely
wealthy to show up at these. It's a community presentation. And I understand you're also going to be doing similar presentations for some school groups, and you're looking for some help to make that happen. So tell us about the July event coming up at the Bonita Museum and Cultural Center.
July 6th, they're going to celebrate Bonita Fest, the celebration of Bonita. And if you recall, in the 1800s, there was really no Bonita as a community, the
right.
ranchos.
Yeah, and those ranchos extended all the way into East County, even though it's a little bit of a misnomer to say it's South Bay Families at the Border, because their ranchos extended to Jamul and
well,
points further
when we,
east.
Yeah, when we talk South Bay, we go all the way east.
Okay.
So yeah.
It's, far from the water.
Yeah. So all the way east.
Yeah.
Because the ranchos,
right,
they were that big.
So tell us about some of the historical characters and stories that are going to come to life at the Bonita Fest this year on July 6th.
Well, one of them I take a lot of pride in because it's actually an ancestor of mine, Bonifacio Lopez. Many people recognize Crosswhite as a family here in the San Diego region. Crosswhites are very prevalent and, of course, part of my family. But Bonifacio Lopez was Philip Crosswhite's father-in-law. And he talks about the cattle industry. And the cattle industry, of course, is huge. Not any bigger in East County than any place else.
Correct.
I mean, East County is huge.
As an aside, I know you were telling me about the origin of the term cowboy was very interesting. It goes to the multicultural roots of our region as well as, you know, somewhat to the prejudices of the nation.
Unfortunately, yes. I say unfortunately because it's evolved into something else. We don't have actual statistics. There were no actual statistics taken as to the ethnicity of the different people that were cattle back in the 1800s. But we know a great number of them were African American, Native American, and Mexican. And the term cowboy actually came from, shall I use this word, go get that cow, boy, because it was an ethnic term referring to the Native Americans, the African Americans, and Mexicans. So it was a degrading term, because if you were white, you were a cattle hand or a cattleman or a wrangler.
Wow.
If you were ethnic, you were a cowboy.
So it wasn't until Hollywood came along and glamorized the whole thing and we had the John Waynes of this world that cowboy became a romanticized positive term.
It actually started with the nickel and dime novels of the 1800s where they glamorized the term cowboy. Because if you think about it, where in the European experience or the Eastern United States experience did they ever handle cattle this way?
Yeah, and the early cattle were not used primarily for beef in our region. Tell us about that.
In Texas, we are very familiar with the roundups and the cattle drives and stuff like that have been glorified so much in movies.
I should throw in here that my own grandfather was a cowboy on the Chisholm Trail in Texas, and his mother was half Native American, so he was one of those Native Americans who was also a cowboy.
Exactly.
So locally.
So locally, we didn't have those long cattle drives. We basically had what we called the matazón, which was a cattle roundup, if you will. And they actually selected the cattle that they were going to sell and butchered them right then and there for the hides, many times laying waste a great deal of the meat.
Yeah, San Diego was the center of the hide and the tallow trade also, right, which is used
for the
candles.
World, not just here locally.
Wow.
It was key to the world economy.
Now, there's a little-known ethnic angle to this also. Tell us about that.
One of the things that's true throughout the history of the United States is the last immigrant usually gets the worst jobs at the lowest pay.
True.
And that has been the history forever. At that particular time, the unique new immigrants were the Pacific Islanders that were coming in on the trading ships.
Fascinating.
So we had Pacific Islanders that landed in California, and what was there to do? The worst job at the lowest pay was tanning the hides at the harbor. So the tanneries were run by Pacific Islanders, and it's hard to find that information in history books.
Now, another of your fascinating stories has to do with your ancestor who was the sheriff, Sheriff Crosswhite. Well, I'll let you tell this story involving hounds and horse thieves.
One of the unique things that were happening during the Gold Rush era is law enforcement in the towns in California was difficult because the miners were actually celebrating to excess, which we don't need to elaborate a whole lot on. Somebody all of a sudden hits it rich, right?
Yeah, they partied hardy.
They did. And so some of the towns, rather than having a sheriff, had a group of men to enforce the law to try to get this celebrations underhand.
A posse, so to speak, or just a group of vigilantes in some cases.
Exactly. And that was the case in San Francisco. And they got a group of guys that were from Australia who were a mixture of law enforcement and criminals.
Oh,
because they were as much of a problem as the people that they were trying to control. So San Francisco had enough of them and said, that's it.
So they kicked them out. The lawmen were lawless and they kicked them out.
And at the same time, there was a significant Native American uprising coming here in Southern California as the Native Americans were being taxed for the first time for the cattle that they owned, not at the point of sale, but at the point of ownership.
So the no new taxes crowd back then was the Native Americans.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So the first year...
History repeats itself, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So the first year, the Native Americans paid the tax. The second year, they go, wait a minute.
We're not going to do that. So in Boston, when this happened, it was called the Boston Tea Party, and they were all celebrated as patriots. But when the Native Americans rebelled against this, tell us what happened.
The Native Americans were trying to organize from the Colorado River all the way to the ocean.
In those days, when you didn't have cell phones and internet?
And you're talking about a lot of different tribes that had different agendas. So it was a major coalition that was being attempted by a Native American chief named Antonio Garza. Okay. Now, Antonio Garza was trying to unite all the Native Americans from the Colorado River. And so the California was trying to organize military forces to come down to Southern California to deal with this issue because they saw it as a significant threat. Here in San Diego, we organized a group of volunteers under a general named Fitzgerald, and they did a preemptive strike in the mountains and attacked the Indians first. That was very effective and dismantled their uprising. However, at the same time, the group of Australians from San Francisco,
the Hounds,
and they were called Hounds, probably referring to the translation of hounds to dogs. So it was meant as an insult that these guys were dogs because they were misbehaved. They were drunkards. They would fight among themselves. They were disrespectful, all of those things. So they came and they camped. First, they came and tried to join the U.S. military here in San Diego. The U.S. military wouldn't have them.
Okay,
because they were that disreputable. So they camped outside of San Diego and were coming into the town, getting drunk, gambling, fighting amongst themselves. There's an incident where one of their own stabbed their leader in a fight. So, I mean, they were disreputable.
Okay.
So Fitzgerald approached the sheriff, which was Philip Crosswhite, my ancestor at the time, and said to him, hey, look, I'm going to give you some of my men so that you arrest these hounds if you see them with any horses or any kind of animals that don't belong to them, because that's what we understand they're doing.
Yeah. And he promptly caught them with some stolen horses from a rancho that he recognized, right?
Yeah, the first incident was actually a mule that belonged to Bandini, which was a reputable person in the town that was well known. So he goes, oh, wait a minute. I know that mule doesn't belong to you. I know who that mule belongs to. Yeah. So they arrested him. Then later on, they found another guy with a horse. They arrested him. So the hounds came into the San Diego Plaza and confronted the sheriff, Philip Crosswhite, demanding that he release the guys that he had arrested. Well, here's a law enforcement. It's not going to release prisoners that violated criminal law to just anybody.
Especially someone who's committing crimes themselves.
Absolutely. So I said, of course, no. Well, then the hounds threatened that they were going to come back and kill Philip Crosswhite and burn down San Diego.
Kill the sheriff and burn the town. So what did the sheriff do?
So he goes out to, there was a military presence by the harbor. So he went down to the harbor and said, hey, look, I'm going to need backup. This is getting serious and this is going to look ugly. He did not wait for them. He rode ahead back into town. He was discussing the situation with the judge, which was Judge Robinson, in the plaza when the hounds came back in. They confronted him again and threatened him and said, release these guys or else. Philip Crosswhite wasn't going to budge. He took a swing at him. Philip Crosswhite ducked this punch. Guy pulled out his gun, aimed it at Philip Crosswhite's chest, and if the gun hadn't backfired, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Oh, my goodness. What a tale that is.
The gun backfired when he's pointing it at his chest. So at this point, discussion's off. The fight's on.
Yeah.
Guns are drawn, and bullets are flying all over. Philip Crosswhite got hit numerous times. As a matter of fact, the newspaper said he was mortally wounded. They expected him to die of his wounds. Okay. But he did shoot the hound that shot him in the leg in such a manner that the guy's leg had to be amputated.
And I understand that after that, Sheriff Crosswhite called in the military nearby, and they came in and quickly.
The military came in immediately right after that. It was just a thing of timing, and the hounds were no match for the military.
So what happened to them?
The military ended up arresting them all. They ended up cutting off the leg of the guy that shot Philip Crosswhite and presented it to Philip Crosswhite as a trophy.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so you can appreciate different values back then.
And then they deported these Australians, the hounds, right?
They did a community collection. Okay, so that the community donated money so that they could get all shipped out, because obviously they didn't have the jails or whatever to keep all these guys.
So in those days, they weren't deporting the Mexicans. They were deporting the Australian immigrants that had come, the white guys. Okay. Listeners, if you just turned in, we're speaking with Victor Crosswhite Contreras, who's sharing with us some colorful tales that you probably haven't read about in your history books, all about the San Diego region's history, that are going to be brought out at this year's Bonita Fest, July 6th, as well as other events
around. The Fundraiser, July 29th.
Right.
And if you're interested, please contact the Bonita Museum. It's going to be a wonderful event, a dinner and entertainment as well.
That sounds great. And then the Bonita Fest, which is a community event later on July 6th. And Victor is looking for supporters to help him bring these stories to schools and other educational groups across the region, and it's all part of this year's 250th anniversary of the founding of the city of San Diego at the very first mission in California. It's a very historic event coming up.
I take a great deal of pride in the presentations that I do at schools, and please understand I do it at university level, secondary and elementary, and I've had wonderful experiences at all levels. For example, UCSD brought me in to do an hour presentation. The Q&A lasted for 2 hours.
Wow, I can sure see why, Victor. It's absolutely fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about the whole evolution of the border history. It's kind of one of those things, the more things change, the more they stay the same in some ways. We've seen both changes, but also some repetition of history happening over and over again. Can you share a little bit of your observations about that?
Well, one of the things that it's very much in the news today, and it actually has very deep roots that are misunderstood, is the military experience in the U.S. by Mexico. We, in fact, have huge percentage of U.S. military that are not U.S. citizens, mostly from Mexico. That's not just now. That's throughout our history.
Yeah, and for decades, centuries maybe, they've been honored for this service and rewarded with citizenship until now.
My father served in World War II. When he joined the Navy, he was still a Mexican citizen.
Yeah, and so the twist now is basically they come back, it's thank you for your service, and by the way, you're getting deported.
Now, I think it's interesting to look at the issue historically, because it makes even more outrageous what's going on now. I have an uncle of mine who also served in World War II, who was captured by the Nazis, and he shared with me how the Germans could not understand why Mexico, whose territory, half of their territory was lost to the United States. They figured Mexico would be a natural ally to the Nazis.
Interesting.
And the Nazis actually courted Mexico to join them.
Adolf Hitler.
Yet they couldn't understand why Mexicans would fight for the United States.
So it's a good point of why it's not a good idea to, tick off our closest neighbor, because you never know when you might need them as an ally if we ever have a future world war again.
One of the huge elements of World War II was the lack of labor in the United States because so many of the men were going off to war.
Yeah, we've heard about Rosie the Riveter and the women who came out of the house to go work, but that wasn't all.
Huge numbers of Mexican citizens that came to the United States and worked. Actually, there was an official agreement between the United States government and Mexico to import labor at that time, because we needed labor in all areas, not just factories.
So they kept our economy going on the home front back then, while the American men were off fighting the war to preserve democracy around the world. So what happened to these sort of unsung heroes after the war?
Well, many of them, like my relatives, my father, my uncle, and stuff like that, became U.S. citizens. Another uncle of mine, my mother's brother, my grandmother made a promise that if he would return from the war, she would rebuild one of the missions in Baja California, which she did over a period of time. So the relationship and the love, we have tributes in Mexico, aka this rebuilt mission, aka a statue of Abraham Lincoln in Tijuana, aka many examples of Mexico acknowledging their love relationship with the United States in the midst of the events of today.
But not all the Mexican workers who came here to work during World War II were that fortunate. Some of them who hadn't become citizens, what happened to them?
Unfortunately, after World War II, there's, for many people, a little-known program of deportation. After bringing in all these workers, after contractually organizing with Mexico to bring in all these workers, after World War II, many were deported unceremoniously. If you're Mexican, you speak Spanish, you were deported, gathered up in cattle cars, and shipped by train back to Mexico. Thank you very much for helping us in World War II.
So the issue of mass deportations and, you know, border conflicts, immigration issues is nothing new. It's sort of come and gone in waves throughout U.S. history, and we're again seeing a resurgence of that sort of thing today. What's your take, Victor, on, you know, 250 years from now, how people might be looking back on the new chapter in border history being written today, right here, right now?
Well, I think that part of the problem is the majority of the country really doesn't understand the border and the dynamics that happen in the border. Rent and housing is so much cheaper 5 miles south,
yeah,
that it's actually a fraction of what you pay in the United States. So a lot of U.S. citizens, as well as Mexicans with documentation to work, live in Mexico. So when you have a shutdown of the border, they can't get to work.
True.
They can't come over here and participate. There's a whole shopping center in San Ysidro being the town closest to the border, for those that may not know. A huge shopping center that had to shut down. The whole shopping center shut down because of the closure, because their customers that come from Mexico couldn't come.
Yeah, it costs the San Diego region economy millions of dollars just for that very brief shutdown that President Trump ordered at one point. It's very, very costly. And of course, now we've got the trade war escalating.
Now, in comparison, it's like, who's really being hurt? Here's whole shopping centers and businesses that had to shut down because their clients or their employees couldn't get there. I guarantee you, because I go to Tijuana every week, there was not one taco stand that shut down in Tijuana with the border crossings. So who did it hurt?
Good point. And of course, you know, for folks in Kansas or wherever, they may not be aware of how many American goods are manufactured in Mexico. When we talk about Americans having to pay higher prices for goods because of the tariffs, we're not talking only about expensive guacamole from the avocados. There are cars manufactured down there, air conditioners, all sorts of things.
Well, something that many people don't realize is a lot of those minor products, and I say minor products because they're not necessarily a brand name, but let's say gloves, workout gloves, small things that somebody comes up with because of NAFTA. It became more economically feasible to build your factory in Tijuana and have those articles manufactured there and then brought back. In essence, it's really a U.S. manufacturer. But to take advantage of the cheaper labor,
yeah,
they build a factory across the border. So it looks like, tastes like an imported good, but in reality, it's U.S. driven.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got time for maybe one more colorful story out of our past. We were talking before we went on the air a bit about the Battle of San Pascual. Do you want to share a little bit about that one?
The Battle of San Pascual is particularly dear to me because I had ancestors on both sides of the battle.
Kind of like the Civil War for some people, okay?
Exactly. I had Philip Crosswhite that fought with the U.S. side and Captain Cota, which was one of the leaders of the Californians.
Okay, so what was it all about?
We had the Mexican-American War. The U.S. forces went to attack the Californios up toward San Pascual.
And the Californios, for those who don't know, can you explain what
the Californianos were? The people from California. And in this particular, because the Californianos were actually very divided.
So these are those Californians of Mexican descent. Yeah. It was their state, their area, before the U.S. suddenly decided.
Yeah, so they were people that were born and raised and owned land and lived here in California. Okay, and I refer to them as Californianos because in many of them, during their lifetime, they saw the government change three times.
Yeah.
It went Spanish, Mexico, U.S.
Okay.
Okay. So they were more attached to California than to any federal government.
You were telling me this is one of those rare battles in history where both sides claim victory. How can that be?
The American troops came and attacked the Californianos. It was in December. The weather was not so good. Back then, most of the weapons used gunpowder. Gunpowder doesn't work so well in moist weather.
Uh-oh. So what happened?
Okay. So the weapons for the U.S. troops were inoperable. The Californianos used lances both to herd cattle, but also as weapons of war. So they could ride through the American troops with their lances and inflicted heavy wounds on the American troops where they suffered almost a 50% casualty rate.
So half of them died at the hands of the Californians.
Or were wounded.
Or were wounded. And I know I've read elsewhere that that winter they were stranded there without supplies, that the situation was so desperate for the American troops that they resorted to eating their own mules at one point.
There's a Mule Hill, for those of us that are here in California, in San Diego, that's exactly where this took place.
So how exactly do the Americans claim victory out of that one?
A lot of these people, these Californianos that were on both sides, knew each other. As I mentioned before, I had ancestors on either side. So after inflicting such significant damage, they said, hey, we're done. We won. We're not here to massacre. We're good. And they left.
So basically, they just said, leave us alone, don't attack us, and we'll let the rest of you live.
We're good. We beat you. We're good.
Okay.
They had sent a small contingency, including Kit Carson, for those of you who like that little
trail
name.
Guide and, Western guide.
My ancestor, Philip Crosswhite, an Indian guide, and I think a couple other guys that they sent back to San Diego to get reinforcements.
What happened when the reinforcements came? So did they go after the Californios again?
They're coming up. The Californianos leave. The U.S. claims victory because they never gave up the land and they never gave up. And the Californianos are claiming victory because, hey, we won the battle and we didn't want to massacre you and we left you guys to survive. So both sides claim victory. It's a rare military battle in that respect.
Absolutely fascinating. Now, listeners, we are speaking with Victor Crosswhite Contreras. He's an actor, writer, all kinds of things with these famous ancestors from our past that he's going to be bringing to life at the Nuestra Frontera event during Bonita Fest. And this will be held at the Bonita Museum and Cultural Center. There is a fundraiser. If you have a little money and want to come help out, that's going to be on June 29th. Or you can just come to the community festival at Bonita Fest on July 6th.
And in Old Town, August 17th. I'd like to share my phone number for booking or additional information on these presentations.
Please
here
do.
In San Diego. It's 619-777-9830.
Very good. We would love to bring you out and do a presentation with East County Magazine to educate some of our radio show listeners and our readers on our website, eastcountymagazine.org, about these colorful, undertold tales from our past in honor of San Diego's 250th anniversary this year. So if there's somebody out there who would like to help us make that happen, maybe you've got a venue that we can bring it out to, let us know. Victor, is there any last words that you have for our listeners today on this 250th anniversary here in San Diego?
I think that San Diego and California have such a rich history. And unfortunately, most of the history books, and I'm throwing this stone, if you will, at the Mexican educational system and the U.S. citizens, most of the history books are written back east and not from a Western perspective.
Exactly.
And forget a lot of the nuances that are California.
Definitely. Well, if you want to get in touch with Victor and bring one of these presentations to a school or another organization, you can reach him at 619-777-9830, and we will be posting this interview on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. Again, we've been listening to Victor Crosswhite Contreras. Victor, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Dennis Ruth, known locally as Mountain Man, has passed away after a battle with cancer. He spent his early years in Santee and the rest of his life in the high desert community of Incopa near Hakumba. His stone cabin became a hidden local treasure which took him 30 years to build, and where he lived without electricity with his dogs and a mule named Big John. Ruth built over 200 houses over his career as a mason and construction worker, including several adobe houses. He was also a leader in the Hakumba Hikers and Walkers group, leading residents and visitors along rugged canyon and mountain trails in San Diego's backcountry desert terrain. He leaves behind countless friends, a large family, and many children, his own, as well as many local children who consider him a father figure. A memorial service for the iconic backcountry leader was held on June 8th at the Desert View Tower. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Goetz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, A.K. Jewell, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Kevin McLeod, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.